Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome back Dr. David Perlmutter, board-certified ophthalmologist at Perlmutter Eye Center in Albany, Clifton Park, and Troy. He also has affiliations with Albany Med, St. Peter's, and Wills Eye Hospital. Dr. Perlmutter specializes in customized cataract surgery, glaucoma treatment, and retinal diseases. He does laser and surgical, the whole nine yards. I'm going to skip some of the words that I mispronounced in the billboard, and we'll just get right to it. Dr. Perlmutter has been ranked by Newsweek magazine as one of the top 150 ophthalmologists in the U.S. You want to be a part of the conversation? Give us a call now, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. David Perlmutter, it's Perlmutter Month. I mean, your wife was on a couple few weeks ago. Now here you are. Whole lot of Perlmutter going on.
That's true. That's a lot of pressure to follow up my wife. She's definitely the better half.
She's very good, but you're also very good, so I'm not worried at all. So, you know, I can't really say intravitreal injections that well. That's putting a needle in the eye, yeah?
It is, yeah.
That's, does anybody do that willingly and placidly?
You'd be surprised at how comfortable we can make it.
Really?
Yeah, I usually tell people it's a lot more gruesome. You know, it sounds a lot more gruesome than it actually is having it done. And we have really nice ways of numbing the eye and making it comfortable. And but the thought is really scary.
It really is. I mean, I would need at least, you know, six shots of bourbon before that happened.
That's the special closet in the office.
Oh, is that where you keep it? The number here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. It's Ophthalmology Today with Dr. David Perlmutter. Anything new at the office, at the practice, that you want to talk about before we start getting to the questions?
Yeah, actually, there's a new treatment for macular degeneration that's FDA authorized. It's photobiomodulation. It's light therapy for early and intermediate dry macular degeneration. So we're in the process of launching that in the office.
What's it called?
It's called photobiomodulation.
What does it mean and what are you modulating?
So it's three different wavelengths of light and it's a number of treatments and it stimulates the mitochondria, which sometimes can have issues in macular degeneration. There's some early data that's suggestive of benefit with early and intermediate macular degeneration.
So mitochondria, if I can remember, 10th grade, is that the energy cell of the...
That is,
okay.
That is.
So what are you doing, bringing them back to life by zapping them with light?
Targeting different parts of it, but yeah, improving the production of energy as well as the antioxidant effects and hopefully keeping down inflammation to preserve the cells.
So interesting. Dr. David Perlmutter joins us today from Perlmutter Eye Center. Tom wrote in very early this morning from Gardner, Mass. Could you talk about stents surgically applied during cataract procedures?
Yeah, so stents for that are applied during cataract surgery goes under the umbrella of what we call minimally invasive glaucoma surgery. So over the last decade, it's been a huge area of development technologically, and we have a number of different procedures that we can do to help with glaucoma, both independent of cataract surgery, but also at the time of cataract surgery. When we're doing cataract surgery, we have small instruments inside the eye doing the surgery. So it's pretty straightforward to do those additional procedures for glaucoma in people who are good candidates and who have glaucoma. The stent is called an eye stent, and I think that's what he's referring to. And it's a microstent. It's the smallest implantable FDA-approved device in the human body.
Really?
And
how do you hold it when you put it in?
It's in an inserter, so it's in a larger instrument that you hold, and you go in through the same little opening that we make for cataract surgery, and then visualize the drainage network of the eye, which starts to function less over time in glaucoma, and put a little stent, and sometimes up to three little stents in that drainage network. And it's like a bypass. It's almost like a plumbing analogy would be a little Roto-Rooter, and you have, or a little bit of stenting open a pipe so that the fluid can flow through it better.
Such an interesting concept. We're joined today by Dr. David Perlmutter. This email question from Nick: is a certain color eye more receptive to light?
So you have to think about people being sensitive to light. There's a lot of factors that go into it. There are certain eye conditions that can make people more sensitive to light. So cataracts sometimes can give people glare symptoms, sometimes dry eyes as well. And the outside of the eye gets dry, the light doesn't get focused as well, and people can feel light sensitive. Or sometimes inflammation inside the eye can make people light sensitive when there's iritis or other forms of inflammation inside the eye. And then some people just are more sensitive than others. We're all human beings. We all have, you know, respond to the same stimuli in our environment a little bit differently. And some people just find themselves more sensitive. As a general rule of thumb, usually lighter eye color, there's less pigment in the eye, less pigment to block light. So we usually say that people with lighter eyes are a little more sensitive to light on average, but everyone is different.
Okay. No, and it really, the white of your eye has nothing to do with anything?
No. The light doesn't pass through the light, through the white part of the eye. The light gets focused by mainly two parts of the eye, the cornea, which is, I call it the car windshield of the eye. It's clear, so you don't see it when you look at someone.
Yeah.
And then the lens of the eye. So those two together do most of the focusing of the light.
And so really, in general, except for some sensitivity, a green eye is just about as sensitive as a brown eye.
Yeah, usually about the same, but people with lighter eyes are a little more sensitive on average.
Very interesting. Dr. David Perlmutter is our guest. One more email, and then we'll either take a break if it's a long answer, or we'll go to the phones. Either way, if you call now, you'll get in. 800-348-2551 is our number if you have a question on ophthalmology today, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. Now, I don't know if this is in your wheelhouse at all. This is from Barb. And Barb writes, for a 68-year-old female with a BRCA1 genetic mutation, what eye issues can develop? Is once a year enough to be screened for these conditions?
So practically once a year is enough to be screened, just like anyone else who we would screen once a year for things like glaucoma and cataracts and macular degeneration. As far as BRCA1, there's some suggestion that retinal cells may have a little bit of change in sensitivity, but nothing that's practical, nothing noticeable. So it wouldn't increase, and there's nothing that we would do for it. So there's no increased screening protocol for BRCA1. In general, to answer that question, just regular screening is okay.
She goes on, says, I have moderate to severe dry eye. Also, I'm taking aromatase inhibitor for hormone-positive breast cancer. Does that have any effect on the eyes?
There are some things that we do increased screening for, like tamoxifen, where we can do some increased screening to look at retinal sensitivity. Sometimes people have macular changes from that.
Yeah. All right. One more email. Then we'll take a break. Then we'll hit the phones. Dr. David Perlmutter is our guest. 800-348-2551. And this one is from Christine. Christine writes, I'm 78-year-old female in good health. Had cataracts removed both eyes approximately 10 years ago. Just had my annual eye exam and was told I have a cataract returning in one eye. Is this common? Well, how can that even happen?
So it's a term that I think is misleading, but people use the term secondary cataract or cataract returning. When we take the cataract out, the cataract is the lens inside the eye getting cloudier as someone gets older. And when we do cataract surgery, we remove the lens and we put in a new artificial lens. It's an implant. So the original cataract can't grow back. You know, it's like if you have a prosthetic in your body, if something else, most of our organs don't regenerate.
What is actually the stuff that makes up a cataract?
So it's a number of different proteins, and there's a capsule that holds it all in place. And so when we do the surgery, we make a controlled opening in the capsule. And if I use the analogy of an M&M, and we take the chocolate and the peanut out, and then the new artificial lens goes into the eye and goes right back into that shell, it opens up inside the shell, and then the shell holds the new artificial lens. Now, when we take a cataract out, the cataract is made up of cells, and cells are tiny and microscopic. And so even though we take out all the pieces that we can see, there still will be a few cells floating around there. And those cells, like a form of scar tissue, can proliferate. They can multiply and grow a little thin sheet or thin film over the back of the artificial lens. If that happens, that film has some clouding to it and can start to affect the vision again. So that term secondary cataract, or sometimes when people say cataract coming back, what they're really referring to is that thin, cloudy sheet growing over the back of the lens. But that's treated differently than cataracts.
All right,
we use a laser. It's a laser. So we use a laser and we clean the film off.
On the back? You can use a laser to get to the back of the lens.
The back of the lens.
How do you do it?
It's on a microscope that looks a lot like the microscope we use to examine eyes. And so we can visualize that film and focus a laser with very, very small spots and clean that film up.
You know, when I talk to surgeons who use laser surgery inside, one of the concerns is always, oh, well, you know, we don't want to go too far or we're going to hit something else. How do you do that? How do you gauge that when you're working in the eye? Because right behind the eye is the brain and stuff like that.
Yeah, so when we're looking through microscopes, it's extremely magnified, and we're looking with depth perception in three dimensions. So with the laser, I can see exactly where that spot is focused. The lasers aren't strong enough to go behind the eye.
Ah, so they're very weak.
So we don't have to worry about that. And there's a lot of different lasers that we use in ophthalmology. So a lot of times patients will say, well, I know someone who had a laser and, you know, they have a concern about something that happened with that person. But there are a number of different lasers we use for all sorts of conditions in the eye.
Yeah.
And some of them have, you know, risks compared to others. As far as cleaning a film off the back of the artificial lens, it's a pretty straightforward, easy thing to do.
Dr. David Perlmutter is our guest. Now, I am told that if this happens, and Christine said it took about 10 years, is that pretty long for a secondary, not a secondary cataract, but the cloud to come back?
So some people get it in months, and some people it's years.
Yeah.
And it's not always the same amount that we end up treating. So, for example, kind of like cataracts, we wait until a person has symptoms and they feel like the symptoms are bothering them. So if two patients come in and have the same exact amount of clouding, you know, of film over the back of the artificial lens, and one person is happy and life is good and,
yeah,
and feels like they're doing all the things they want to do with their vision, we're probably not going to clean that film off.
But I've often been told as well that it'll only happen once if it comes back. Is that true?
Almost always.
Why?
In medicine, we have to catch everything.
There's, why though?
So that capsule analogy, the M&M analogy, those cells use the back of the capsule as a scaffolding, and they grow along that scaffolding, and that's that film, that cloudy film. So when we use the laser, we intentionally break part of that scaffolding, and that prevents the cells from growing back over that area.
Ah, okay. Dr. David Perlmutter is our guest. We'll take a break. We'll hit the phones after that. 800-348-2551 is our number. Back in a flash. Deep Blue Organ Trio doing an old Stevie Wonder, Jesus Children of America, here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Medical Monday, and we're joined today by Dr. David Perlmutter, a bird certified. Oh, man, I got to tell you something.
So second career.
My cat woke me up at 2 a.m., and I didn't get back to sleep. So I may be in trouble for the second half of the show. You just take it from there. He's a board certified ophthalmologist at Perlmutter Eye Center. And let's just cut our losses and hit the phones. Helena's in Amherst. Helena, you're on.
Hi. I have some questions about myopic degeneration. Like, what exactly is it? And is there anything that can be done to prevent it or to slow it down?
So myopic degeneration, myopic means, it refers to myopia, which is nearsightedness. So myopic degeneration happens in people typically who are nearsighted. And the more nearsighted a person is, the more of a chance that they can have myopic degeneration. The most important relevant thing for myopic degeneration is when there's retinal changes that occur in the center part of your vision, because that's the most important part that we use. And the reason that this happens is that myopic eyes are larger. The length of the eye is longer, greater than the average eye. And the more myopic, mm-hmm, on average, the larger the eye. And the retinal tissue, if you think of it as like tissue paper, it's stretched along the back wall of the eye. And the larger the eye, the more that tissue gets stretched out and the more of a chance that some of that tissue starts to break down. And so myopic degeneration is when the retinal tissue starts to break down, and it can happen in the center parts of the vision and affect people's vision. It can be very mild and not really affect someone's vision at all, or not affect it in a way that they notice, or it can lead to significant vision loss. In general, for most of the scenarios, there's not a lot that can be done. However, there are some scenarios where people develop some fluid or bleeding in the retina, that can exacerbate the degeneration, and that responds well to injections of medication into the eye in the same way that we use it for macular degeneration, similar medications.
Helena.
Well, I was told that UV rays, staying away from UV rays might be helpful.
Well, in general, UV light's not great for the retina. So it's wise to wear sunglasses and limit that exposure, but wouldn't avoid that altogether.
All right. Thanks for the call. Do you wear sunglasses all the time?
No.
No?
when it's sunny out, when it's bright.
Do all doctors just say, do as I say, not as I do? Is that what happens here? You should be wearing sunglasses, man.
Well, can I borrow yours?
These are transition lenses. If you use these, you won't be able to see a thing, which would kind of be funny. We'd be in the same boat here today. Let's go to Cookie in Westchester. Cookie, you're on.
Hi. Thank you so much. I have macular degeneration, and since you just said that there's a new product out that could help me, I'd like you to spell it because you said it so fast I couldn't get it.
It's called photobiomodulation.
Photobiomodulation.
The system is
How do you spell bio?
Well, how about we use we'll use the name brand of the system, which is Valeda. It's VALEDA.
B as in baby or P as in Peter?
V as in Victor.
V as in Victor. Oh,
Valeda.
I can't hear it.
Valeda.
Say it again, please.
One more time, Doc.
V as in Victor. A-L-E-D as in dog, A.
B as in David, and then A.
That's right.
Okay. Thank you so much. I'm going to get in touch with my guy.
Cookie, thanks a lot. We appreciate the call. You know, we really should do the show in semaphore, and then everyone can understand, even without a radio. Let's go to Mary in Vermont. Mary, you're on.
Hello?
Hello, you're on.
Oh, thank you. You're very faint. It's a little hard to hear. I'm calling about a question. I have glaucoma. I've had for some years, and there's a recommendation recently for a procedure on one eye. The pressure is much higher, which is unusual, than the other. And it had to do with lasers and some kind of a circular effect that would bring down the pressure in the eye so that the drops would no longer be needed. And I couldn't quite understand the procedure, so I was hoping you could, explain it a little better so I could understand it.
Okay. Well, I'm happy to do that, Mary. There are a couple things that are done for glaucoma. Probably what you're describing is selective laser trabeculoplasty, or SLT for short. And that's done on a microscope, much like we use in an examining room. And we use that laser and we place little laser spots on the trabecular meshwork, which is the drainage system of the eye. The drainage system of the eye, like our bathtub drain, gets a little bit clogged up over the years and doesn't work quite as well. And then pressure builds up in the eye. And so that's the most common reason that pressure starts to get higher.
Can I interrupt you for 1 second?
Sure.
I neglected to tell you that I've actually had trabeculectomies in both eyes, also cataract surgery many years ago. But so I have had actually surgery to make a little flap, I guess, in the eyeball.
Yeah,
trabeculectomies.
So trabeculectomy is making an incision through the trabecular meshwork in the operating room,
right,
to allow fluid to leave the eye through that incision to keep the pressure low. So a laser trabeculoplasty is where laser spots are put on the trabecular meshwork. And because that structure is 360 degrees around inside your eye, we use a special lens to visualize it and then place laser spots on it, usually 360 degrees.
Okay, Mary.
And that would be probably what they're talking about?
That's probably what they're talking about, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Dr. David Perlmutter today, ophthalmology. And let's go now to Saratoga and Cheryl. Cheryl, you're on.
Hi. I have had floaters for decades. I'm 60 now, and my doctor said the 60s, this decade will be the decade I get, what's that surgery? The eye surgery.
Cataract?
Yeah, yeah. But in addition to that, I have these floaters, and my doctor said that there is a procedure now that is being done where they zap them, but it's not covered by insurance. And it sounded a little sketchy, and I wanted to hear if this was a safe thing to consider or to just not consider it.
So in general, just a little background about where floaters come from. Your eye is filled with a gel substance. And as we get older, that gel substance starts to change in its composition, and you can get protein deposits in it, cholesterol deposits in the gel. But then most commonly, and this happens in almost everyone at some point in their lifetime, the gel releases from the back wall of the eye. And when it does that, it moves around a little more freely inside the eye. And that's usually when someone sees a larger floater. That larger floater, usually notice less and less over time. Your brain just sort of filters it out from your vision for you and stops showing it to you as much. So usually it becomes less noticeable. And then there are other things that can contribute to floaters along the way, like if someone has any bleeding inside their eye, pigment cells inside the eye, things like that can get trapped in that gel substance and give additional floaters. So in general, I usually encourage people to try to just live with the floaters and get used to it, because that's most commonly what happens. There are two ways of trying to alleviate floaters. One is surgical, where someone goes in with small instruments and cleans the gel substance out of the eye. And the second one, which is what you're describing, which is actually using that same laser we were discussing earlier that cleans the film off the back of the artificial lens, and focusing that laser on a floater and then zapping the floater with it. Now, the data is not hugely conclusive as to whether or not that's helpful. So there's a small study out of Dr. Shaw in Boston, and that was specifically for what we call posterior vitreous detachment, where that gel is separated off the back wall of the eye. The person has already had cataract surgery, and you can visualize like one large floater that we see when we're looking inside on the microscope. And in that study, and it was a relatively small one, they were able to break that floater up into smaller pieces. And sometimes people saw some smaller floaters, but in general, the overall, there was some subjective improvement on average. But there was a really small subset. And as a general rule, most ophthalmologists aren't really offering that as a treatment, but it's not to say that it can't work. But it's important that if it's going to be done, it's done in the right scenario, because you can't just get rid of small pigment cells or cholesterol cell or cholesterol deposits or things like that with a laser.
Cheryl, thanks a lot for the call. All right. Try to explain, make it simple for me. How can you see a floater if it's behind the lens? In other words, we've all seen floaters before. How are we, is it a shadow? How are we picking up how are we picking this up?
So the lens allows light to pass through it. So just like you can see out through a lens, you know, I can look in under a microscope in the office and see through the lens of the eye into the cavity and also in all the way back to the retina and the optic
nerve.
So the
retina is where the data is being processed. So
exactly.
It's between the lens and the retina.
So light comes from the outside world and it comes as light rays. And those light rays are focused by the cornea and by the lens.
Got it.
And the goal is to focus those light rays on the retina, ideally on the center part of the retina. Now, if there's anything in the way, there can be a shadow that's cast on the retina.
Interesting.
And so when the gel substance of the eye releases from, or when you have deposits in the gel substance, so when it releases from the back wall from the retina, or when there are deposits, that light, as it transmits through the cornea, through the lens, and is on its way to the retina, it hits one of those little deposits, or it hits that released gel and casts a shadow on the retina. Now, when it's brand new and it's happening for the first time, your brain is on high alert and lets you know it's there.
Yep.
And so usually you're very aware of it right away. But if you think about it, there are other things in our vision that we don't typically notice day in and day out. So if you pay attention, you'll realize your nose is in your vision. But when you're walking around most days, you don't think much about it. So as something is there for longer, the brain is very powerful and typically starts to show it to you less.
I call it digital signal processing.
Yeah.
The brain just filters it out. All right, let's go to, while we're on the topic of floaters, let's go to New York City. James, you're on. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. I had a fall recently. I kind of went head first on a sidewalk, and I had a minor concussion, didn't pass out. But now I have a new, really prominent floater in my left eye. It's really irritating. It's right in the middle of my vision, and especially bad when I look at a computer screen. And I'm wondering if it's something I should see an ophthalmologist about. Did I suffer retinal damage?
So I'm sorry you had that fall. That sounds terrible.
It was.
Now, anytime you have new floaters, and this is important if anyone's listening, anytime there are new floaters in the vision, it's important to get checked right away.
Okay.
Usually within 24 hours. And the reason is that that floater, you know, we were talking about different reasons earlier that floaters can happen. But when that gel substance that's stuck to the retina releases off from the retina, most of the time it comes off and you just see a floater. But as it's coming off, sometimes it pulls on the retina and tears it. And those tears can lead towards retinal detachments where people can require surgery and even have permanent changes in their vision going forward. And you won't know, just seeing a floater, you don't know as a person whether or not you have a tear in the retina back there. So you really need to get seen by an ophthalmologist, have them take a look, because if there is a tear, it can usually be lasered and sealed so that it doesn't become a retinal detachment.
Oh, now this happened about a month ago. Does that affect?
Better get in there.
You were saying as soon as you can.
Yeah, usually you want to get seen as soon as you can. Even though it was a month ago, I'd still recommend you get checked.
All right, James, thanks a lot. One more call, then we'll take a break. Then we'll go back and check the email bag for a couple of minutes. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Dr. David Perlmutter, certified ophthalmologist at Perlmutter Eye Center. And let's go to Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
Why would a cataract develop in one eye and not the other?
Why would a cataract develop in one eye and not the other, doctor?
So, Jim, usually cataracts are going to develop in both eyes, at least at some point along the way. And our bodies are usually somewhat symmetrical, but usually not perfectly symmetrical. You know, it's kind of like when you get arthritis in your knees and usually one knee starts to hurt first, but usually there's some arthritis lurking in the other knee. And the same is true for the eyes with cataracts. Usually when someone comes in and has cataracts that are asymmetric, where one cataract, you know, the lens in one eye is cloudier than the lens in the other, usually the other eye at least has a little bit of clouding in it. But there are always exceptions to every rule. And sometimes for reasons we don't always know, we can have someone come in and really have very, very asymmetric cataracts. And sometimes we don't have an explanation. Other times there are explanations. For example, if someone has an inflammatory condition in the eye, that makes the lens get cloudier faster. Or if they've had prior eye surgery inside the eye, that also can make the lens get cloudier earlier than it would have otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Do you have that issue, Jim? Apparently Jim is now. All right, let's just take a break. I think Jim is in dreamland now. 800-348-2551. You see, it's the soothing voice of Dr. David Perlmutter that puts all the patients to sleep. We'll be back. All right, so the Vox Pop Gardening Show is heading out on the road April 22nd. That's Earth Day. And we're going to the Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York. Fred Breglia, proprietor. If you have a gardening question and you want to meet the gang, we'll have the garden all-stars there to answer your questions. We'll do a live show. We'll tape it. And then we'll air it later in May. But the event happens on Earth Day, April 22nd, at the Landis Arboretum. Am I going to be there? Heck yeah, I'm going to be there. Tickets and info available at wamc.org/on the road. It's Ophthalmology Today with Dr. David Perlmutter. And let's do a couple emails here before we go back to the phones. This one's from Ann. Are there any foods people can eat to improve their eye health and ward off problems? Is it true carrots is good for the eyes? That's from Ann.
So, Ann, in general, heart-healthy diets are good when we're talking about retinal health, especially for people who have macular degeneration. So there's a large study, the age-related eye disease study, number one and number two, that was done by the National Eye Institute and looked at specific vitamin combination, which you find over the counter on the shelf called the AREDS2 formula, which showed benefit in people who had intermediate to advanced macular degeneration.
Right.
And that decreased the risk of developing wet macular degeneration. But as far as day in and day out for the average person, there's not a vitamin or a specific thing that you have to do nutritionally for eye health.
I had some carrots on Friday during the Food Friday show. Only a couple forkfuls, but I have X-ray vision now. It's perfect. Did you know, and I don't know if this is true, apparently, I read this somewhere that's somewhat reputable, not the internet per se, that this whole business about carrots improving your vision was done by the Allies to fool the Nazis. Did you hear about this?
I did. This was.
Did you tell me that?
So this was in a lecture at one point, and it was before the days where we could fact check that easily. And honestly, I haven't thought of it in a very long time.
Yeah, so it's
not
true.
I haven't fact checked it, but in a lecture, the person delivering the lecture was talking about how it had to do with fooling the Germans.
The Norton bomb site and everything else. They didn't want them to know about that technology.
And they didn't want to know that they had certain information about the radar. And so they had this rumor that, carrots were helping the eye health.
Yeah.
So that it would distract from the real reason that they were able to identify those targets.
Do me a favor. Before your next appearance, can you fact check that one? Because I've said it a couple times on the show now. And let's see. All right, a couple more emails, and then we'll go back to the phones. John writes in, when I drive to work in the morning and it's dark, I'm not aware of any night vision problems. But then when I drive home in the dark, I'm aware of some double vision. Seems to be related to fatigue. What's happening? And that's from John.
So, John, when it comes to double vision in the eye, there's a really important distinction that we make. We call it monocular or binocular. Monocular means that you see the double vision out of one eye by itself. So let's say the double vision is out of the right eye, you cover your left eye, you see double out of your right. Or you cover your right and maybe you see double out of your left, that would be monocular double vision in the left eye. There's also a type of double vision called binocular, and that's double vision that only exists when both eyes are open together. So you see double with both eyes open, but when you close either eye, the double vision goes away. And the reasons for double vision, the etiologies, are completely different depending on whether it's monocular or whether it's binocular. Let's just for, hypothetical sake, say that what you're describing is binocular double vision. And with binocular double vision, it happens when the two eyes are not looking at the exact same focus point at the same time. So two different images are then sent to the brain, and the brain at times we'll merge those two images together for you if they're close enough together, or if you're feeling, energetic and you just had a good night's sleep. And if the brain fuses those two images together, then you see single.
Yeah.
If the brain can't fuse those two images together for you, then you see double. And so each eye can be healthy enough on its own, but it's the two working together that is the problem in binocular double vision. And then, the reasons for why that happens, there's a ton of reasons. So it can be anything from brain all the way to small nerves that leave your brain and travel to the eye muscles and attach to the eye muscles around the eye, to the eye muscles themselves, to the eyes themselves. So there are a lot of different possibilities. But first, it's important to check that at home. And the easiest way to do that is to cover one eye at a time. Kind of hard to do when you're driving, but maybe when you're a passenger in the car instead of behind the wheel.
Yeah, it's not a good idea, right? Don't close both eyes when you're driving, right? Yeah.
That's definitely not a good idea.
All right, one more email for now, and then we'll get back to the phones. Dr. David Perlmutter is with us today. It's ophthalmology. This one from Nancy in Western Massachusetts. Retinal artery occlusion. She says, my husband had a retinal artery occlusion. Thankfully, some of his vision came back. He's taking Wegovy. Could that have been the cause of the occlusion? Careful. You'll get sued. Yeah. So be very careful with your answer.
Ray, do we have one of those commercials with the disclaimers where you put it on and it just goes through all of the different possible side effects?
Don't take if you're allergic to blah, blah, blah. No, I don't know. All right, so what do you think?
So, Nancy, when we talk about vessel occlusions in the eye, there are artery occlusions and there are vein occlusions, and they're very different from each other. You said an artery occlusion. So arteries bring blood to the tissue, and if part of the retinal artery or if the retinal artery that serves the entire eye gets blocked, then there's a lack of blood flow to either a portion or to the whole retina, and then that tissue tends to die off. And it's an analogy is like having a stroke inside the eye, and the tissue that dies off doesn't come back. So unfortunately, we don't know how to regenerate that tissue. We don't have the science for that. Sometimes an artery gets clogged with a little clot, and then the clot breaks up and then travels downstream. And then the tissue that was initially not getting enough blood flow then gets enough blood flow before it dies off and recovers. But yeah, you mentioned Wegovy. I'm not familiar with Wegovy as a cause of artery occlusion. Most commonly, arteries occlude either from a clot that travels somewhere in the body. So it could come from, you know, in the body and work its way to the eye and block up a blood vessel, or just a blood vessel occludes at some point along the track of either the central retinal artery entering the eye or one of the branches as it goes through.
Could you use a laser as a sort of a roto-rooter and clear out the artery?
That's a good idea. That's been tried in vein occlusions, but these are the arteries are so small, no one's been able to do that and demonstrate success.
All right. Well, actually, I have to do one more email and then we'll move on. I've been seeing products, says Rosemary, online that are meant to clean your eyelids. If you suffer from Demodex blepharitis, are these safe and do they work?
So Demodex is a mite, and it's a mite that often lives in our hair follicles, both our eyelash follicles and sometimes around our face and hair follicles. It sounds really disgusting.
Yes, it does.
When you say it out loud, but it's present on most people and we don't think much about it. But sometimes the presence can cause issues. It can cause a rash on the skin, which I'll leave that one to my wife from a couple weeks ago for
yes.
any follow-up questions.
Sure.
But
maybe you could be on together like Sonny and Cher at one of these times.
Oh, I don't know if we want that comedy duo.
No, okay, fair enough.
So the Demodex mite can also live in the hair follicles for the eyelashes and create some inflammation of the oil glands that provide oil to the surface of the eye. So there are products over the counter that traditionally we would use that have tea tree oil. But now there's a prescription eye drop that is effective at killing off those mites for people who are symptomatic. So I'd recommend sticking with the product that we know and have really good data for that works.
But the mites generally do good things, right?
We don't know of any good things they're doing, but
why are they here?
That's a good question.
I mean, seriously, how many little tiny things are crawling around on us? All right, fine. I'll ask your wife. Whatever. Nikki in Vermont, you're on with Dr. David Perlmutter.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. And apologies if you've already addressed this question.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Oh, perfect. All right. So I'm 60 years old and I have pathologic myopia diagnosed about 20 years ago. So it's probably been about 10 years since I've had injections. But my vision is definitely slowly getting worse. So besides going to see my eye doctor every 3 months, are there any therapies or treatments or anything out there to help me?
So, Nikki, it sounds, I think if you were listening earlier, we were talking about myopic degeneration. So it sounds
I missed that one.
Yeah, okay, that's okay. It sounds like you have some myopic degeneration, which is where the retina degenerates, especially in the center parts of the vision, from being nearsighted. And that can also come with some swelling or bleeding that occurs in the retina. And then we treat with injectable medicines, much like you're describing. And there's not a whole lot that we can do apart from controlling any fluid or bleeding that's there with the injectable medicines. But also you want to make sure that you're maximizing every other part of your vision that can be addressed. So if someone has cataracts or if they have dry eyes or if they just need to make sure they have the best possible glasses prescription, you want to make sure that you're addressing every other part of the vision that can be influenced or improved, because we can't repair retinal tissue if it's atrophied or if it's damaged.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Nikki, thanks a lot for the call. Paul in Albany says, for what it's worth, the story I've heard from several different places about World War II eyesight improvement involved bilberries, supposedly in jelly on toast, helping British fighter pilots, not regarding bombers or bomb sites, and so it wasn't carrots.
Good to know.
Isn't that good to know? Let's go to Meg in Beacon. Meg, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I am getting ready for cataract surgery, and I have nearsightedness and pretty much bad eyesight, astigmatism. Is there any guiding principle? Like, I know they have the lens that can be inserted to help correct some of your vision, but it's kind of overwhelming to think of it all. Is there any guiding principle? Like, how do you pick what type of lens?
That's a really good question. So there are a lot of different options for artificial lenses that can go inside the eye with cataract surgery. There's the typical lens that's covered by the insurance, and then there are a number of other options that people sometimes choose. And there's financial cost involved. You know, usually there's out-of-pocket costs to those other lenses. So my general rule of thumb is that you understand how you use glasses right now. Some people wear glasses all the time for everything. You know, they use the top part of their glasses for distance, the bottom part for close. They never take them off, you know, and from the moment they wake up till they go to sleep at night. There are other people that just carry reading glasses around and they can see well far away, and then they just put reading glasses on when they want to see closer. And then there are people who are nearsighted and they can see up close without glasses, but they can't see far away without glasses. So some people who are nearsighted will find as they get older, they like to take their glasses off and utilize that near vision when they want to see up close. And then they put their glasses back on more for their faraway vision. So as a general rule of thumb, if you're used to a specific way that you use glasses, then I usually recommend you try to keep it that way after surgery. So we mimic the what you're used to, or make you less dependent on glasses altogether with one of those other lens options. But where people typically would get frustrated is when something changes. So if you're someone who takes their glasses off to see up close, and that's what you've been doing for decades, and all of a sudden we put a lens in that makes it so that you can't do that anymore, and now you have to carry reading glasses around, it's completely different than what you're used to. And that's usually where people get frustrated.
Okay, Meg.
Right. Hard to change.
Yep.
Yep.
Thanks for the call. As I recall, I had one cataract done years ago, and they basically said, well, do you want to see up close or see far away? And then I think one of the options you're alluding to is, do they have bifocal cataract lenses?
Yeah, they're
progressive or whatever.
There are lenses called extended depth of focus, and there are lenses called multifocal lenses. Extended depth of focus is a increased range of the vision, typically from distance into some aspect of intermediate vision.
Yeah.
Kind of like fingertip area.
Yeah.
And then multifocal means multiple focus. So there's multifocal where there are two focal points, a distance and a reading. And then there are trifocal multifocals, which have a distance, an intermediate, and a close focus.
Okay. So that must take some training for you, the user, not the doctor, but someone who gets it. I remember getting progressive lenses, and it took some time to learn how to be comfortable in them.
So it's different than the way that progressives are designed in glasses, because in progressive glasses, there are different parts of the glass.
Yeah.
You know, you have to look progressively down through the glass to get to the different focus points. The artificial lenses have concentric rings designed into them that give different focal points.
Oh, so interesting.
So you don't have to look in different places to get the different focal points. Those focal points are all there from just when you look at something.
Why can't they do glasses like that?
That's a good question. It's different when you have something either that sits on the surface of your eye or inside your eye versus outside your eye, where there's a space between the eye and the glass itself.
All right, let's go to Deborah in Matamoros. Another person from Matamoros. Deborah, you're on.
Hi, my name's Debbie, and I have had a long history in terms of eye development and eye care. My current call has to do with mestasis. Last year, I was complaining of itching in my eyes. My eyes were red, bloodshot most of the time. I went to see my optometrist, and she gave me mestasis, and that made my eyes hurt more and feel more dry. And I don't know why Restasis was the product I should be taking, or should I just roll with this?
Okay.
So there are a number of different treatment options for dry eyes, ranging from over-the-counter products, lubricant drops, to different prescription medications that are in eye drop form, as well as a prescription nasal spray and an oral nutritional supplementation. So there are a number of different options. It sounds like things are not going particularly well with the Restasis. You're not getting symptom relief. When it comes to dry eyes, there's dry eyes where I tell people that the eye looks healthy enough, but clearly they have symptoms, and those symptoms are a nuisance to them.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are dry eyes where I'm concerned about the long-term eye health based on the way the eye looks. Mm. If it's just about symptom relief, then it's about finding the right eye drop combination or the right regimen for you that makes your eyes feel better. And that's a conversation you definitely want to have with your optometrist about what other treatment options there are.
Deborah, thanks a lot. Let's quickly go to Westfield. Mike, you're on with Dr. David Perlmutter.
Hey, Doc. Hey, everybody.
Hi.
Hey, Mike.
Question about, I get a sharp pain pretty frequently in either eye. I went to the optometrist. You know, they blew the air in there, and they looked. They couldn't see anything. But the sharp pain, it hurts.
So Mike, sometimes, you know, it's hard to say for sure just over the radio. But sharp pains often come from the cornea on the outside, and
okay,
it sounds like it happens from time to time. So it's possible that the moment that you had the sharp pain was different than the moment that you're in the office when they're actually taking a look at your eye.
Right.
So it's hard to say without looking at it, but often people with dry eyes will get sharp pains because the cornea is extremely sensitive.
Oh, she did tell me I did have dry eyes.
There you go.
That she did. All righty. Thank you very much, guys.
You're welcome.
Let's quickly go. We don't get too many calls from Missouri, so let's go to line 5. Gary, you only have about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Okay. Yes, I'm myopic. I had an injury to my right eye, and I have a cloudy vitreous. Wonder if there's a lens implant when I get the vitreous replaced that would give me better farsightedness.
All right, Gary. So I think what you're referring to is cataract surgery, because the vitreous is the gel inside the eyeball, and that one, if you have that removed.
No, I had an injury to my eye and the vitreous became cloudy. The injury was a bad surgery to fix my lens.
Okay. Only about 20 seconds left here.
So if you have surgery, to remove the vitreous gel, there's nothing implanted afterwards that fixes the vision.
And Gary, I'm sorry. We're going to have to leave it there.
I'm asking at the same time.
All right. Well,
my question is, can I have a lens replacement at the same time that will improve my nearsightedness?
Okay. Go ahead.
That's a big question. So it depends on the health of the rest of the eye. It depends on whether you currently have the natural lens or you have an artificial lens, if someone already had cataract surgery.
Okay.
In the real world, anything can be done, but it often depends on a risk-benefit profile for whether it's worth it.
We're going to have to leave it there, Gary, but thank you for the call from Missouri already. Dr. David Perlmutter, if people want to find out about Perlmutter Eye Center, how do they do that?
Our website, pearleyecenter.com, and or, you know, you come to the office for an appointment.
You know what? Great job today. Interesting program, right?
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
All right, we'll see you soon. Support comes from Daughters of Sarah, Albany, New York, providing a continuum of care for seniors, offering them opportunities to live at age gracefully with dignity and respect. Daughtersofsarah.org. Thanks again to Dr. David Perlmutter of Perlmutter Eye Center for being here today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for calling. Thanks for the emails. I apologize if we didn't get to yours. A ton of calls and emails we didn't get to, but Dr. Perlmutter will be back. Trust me on that. Tomorrow, it's weather with meteorologist Ryan Finn. We'll see you at 2:00.